The Supreme Court heard arguments today in a case testing the federal government's zero-tolerance drug policy at public housing projects. The policy allows a whole household to be evicted if even a single member of the household is found to be involved in drug activity anywhere. NPR's legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg reports.
The zero-tolerance policy is aimed at purging drugs from publicly funded residential housing. Enacted into law at the height of the crack epidemic, the policy requires all public housing authorities receiving federal money to include in their leases a so-called one-strike provision. It informs the lease signer that any drug-related activity on or off the premises engaged in by the tenant or any member of the tenant's household or any guest of the household will result in eviction of the entire household. The policy was challenged by three elderly grandmothers living with extended families in Oakland, California public housing. Mrs. Pearlie Rucker, for example, had warned her family repeatedly of the consequences if any one of the children, grandchildren, or great-grandchildren living with her was found using drugs, and she routinely searched her mentally retarded daughter's room. But when that daughter was caught three blocks away from the project with cocaine, the whole family was served with a notice of eviction. Mrs. Rucker, along with others, then went to court to challenge the policy. They won, and the government appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, where today their lawyer said the one-strike policy does nothing more than make drug victims of innocent family members. Lawyer Paul Rennie spoke to reporters outside after the argument.
They weren't causing any drug problems, so you're turning them into victims of drugs. The thing to do is deal with the people who are causing the drug problems and get them out.
But Gary Lafayette, the lawyer for the Oakland Housing Authority, disputed that.
There's already someone out there who is desperately trying to get into public housing. What we're really doing is exchanging someone who will not follow the rules and replacing them with someone who will.
Inside the courtroom, the bulk of the government's argument defending the one-strike policy was made by Assistant Solicitor General Jim Feldman. Justice O'Connor, is it your position that the government can put any terms or conditions on a lease that it wants to, as long as it doesn't violate some constitutional provision like the First Amendment? Answer, yes. O'Connor, but this does seem to operate in a rather draconian fashion, and one wonders why the government wants to operate that way. Answer, it would be too difficult to administer the policy any other way. There's no way of knowing what the other members of the household may have known. Justice Ginsburg wondered, why not hold a tenant responsible only for the conduct on the premises? Answer, drug activity in a parking lot or in a nearby location may be more threatening to the peace and safety of the project than it is inside an apartment. Justice Ginsburg, are there any limits as to time or place? What about a drug offense that occurred 5 years ago? Or a youngster who uses drugs on a visit to Los Angeles, but his home is in Oakland? Answer, place is not relevant. A drug crime can occur 3,000 miles away and still be related. And there's no time limitation either. In all, though, the government's advocate seemed to fare well. Not so for the lawyer representing the grandmothers, Paul Rennie. Under HUD's policy, he said, the Public Housing Authority is both judge and jury as to whether innocent tenants can be evicted. Chief Justice Rehnquist, it's no different for any other tenant. Answer, under most state laws, courts have the power to conclude an eviction is not justified. And the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals said here that Congress didn't intend to take away the innocent tenant's defense. Justice Kennedy, the question is whether this is a legal defense. Answer, it's recognized in the state courts. Justice O'Connor, but it isn't in the federal statute. It was manufactured by the Ninth Circuit. It just isn't there. Chief Justice Rehnquist, you ordinarily can't say, don't evict me, if the lease says you can. Lawyer Rennie then contended that if Congress did intend to create a lease without allowing the tenant a chance to show her innocence, then the one-strike law would be unconstitutional. Why? Asked Chief Justice Rehnquist. Answer, because it would be a punishment without any sort of a finding of guilt. Rehnquist, then every evicted tenant in America is being punished. Justice Souter, are you saying nobody can be made the guarantor of behavior for a third party? Answer, not in the public housing context. Lawyer Rennie, now faced with a court that seemed unanimously doubtful of his argument, literally threw his hands in the air. This policy is no deterrent, he said. Pearlie Rucker took every step she knew to avoid her family using drugs. She warned them, she searched their rooms. Justice Scalia, she may have been blameless, but she didn't do what she agreed to under the lease, make sure no one in her household engaged in drug activity. Answer, in the real world, you don't forfeit your house if one person who lives there smokes a marijuana cigarette. In the real world, the justices seemed, however, unpersuaded. A decision in the case is expected by summer. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
In an Atlanta courtroom today, a leader of the Black Power movement of the 1960s fought for his own life. Jameel Abdullah Al-Amin, formerly known as H-Rap Brown, is charged with murdering a sheriff's deputy and wounding another. The state is seeking the death penalty. NPR's Joshua Lebs was in court today and joins us now. Joshua, first, the prosecution. How did they open their case?
Very dramatically, Robert. Prosecutor Kelly Stevens stood before the jury, and these were the first words she said. She said, quote, "Please don't shoot me anymore." Then she went on to say that is what a Fulton County deputy said to the defendant when he was shooting him repeatedly on the night of March 16, 2000. The prosecution went on to really lay out the case in some intricate detail. They used the full hour that they had, and they went through a lot of the evidence that the jury will be hearing about. They said they will show that two officers went to serve a warrant on March 16, 2000 to Jameel Abdullah Al-Amin. They say they'll be able to show that he was standing outside of his black Mercedes and that he was holding two weapons. One was a rifle, they say, and one was a shotgun. They said they'll be able to show shell casings to prove that he was standing right outside his car and that when the two officers arrived and approached him at his car, that he shot at them. They said they'll have a positive identification from one of the officer who survived that night, who was able to identify Jameel Abdullah Al-Amin from a photograph lineup while lying in a hospital bed. They also said they'll be able to show that when he escaped to Whitehall, Alabama, that when they found him, right near him, were both of the weapons that authorities insist he used that night. One more point, Robert. Mm-hmm. When the prosecution opened its case today, they used their opening to counteract some of the holes that they expect there to be in the case. They went right into some problems they know there are. For example, one officer originally said he looked Al-Amin in the eyes and saw that his eyes were gray. Al-Amin's eyes are not gray. The officers at one point believed that there was a blood trail. In fact, there was no blood trail. And the prosecution insisted they'll be able to show that those were honest mistakes early on in the investigation, but that unquestionably he is the guilty one.
Well, so said the prosecution. What did the defense say?
Well, the defense wasted no time poking holes in the case. The defense said several things. First of all, they said the identification by the surviving officer, which really, they say, the prosecution has been going on ever since it happened, was completely untrustworthy. They say he was in the hospital on morphine, expecting to look specifically for a picture of Jameel Abdullah Al-Amin out of the options that he was given. They also say that this officer's testimony is just not trustworthy, that at one point he said that Al-Amin had gray eyes. Later he said Al-Amin was actually wearing yellow sunglasses. They also said they suggested that Al-Amin might have been framed. They said the evidence that was found in Whitehall, Alabama, the two weapons and some of his clothes and also the black Mercedes, which was found in Whitehall, Alabama, they say it was all too conveniently placed there. And they'll be able to show that Jameel Abdullah Al-Amin was not the shooter, that those might have gotten there in some other way, and that there is no evidence directly linking him to the crime.
Thank you, Joshua.
Thank you.
NPR's Joshua Lebb speaking with us from Atlanta about the murder trial of Jameel Abdullah Al-Amin, formerly known as H. Rap Brown.